Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The West has been at war with Russia for a very long time. Currently, this is expressed through NATO's proxy war on Russia. Losing in Ukraine, NATO has turned to asymmetrical warfare, including terrorism. Instead of a negotiated peace, we are again going up the escalation ladder. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Rossi in New York. He is a lecturer of political science at Rutgers University. In Miami, we have Nicholas Davies. He is an independent journalist as well as co-author of War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. And in Bangkok, we cross to Angelo Giuliano. He is a political and financial analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you. This may sound like a trick question, but it's not. This conflict is far from over. You'll notice I didn't say the conflict in Ukraine is far from over. Michael, I think you get my point.
Yes, absolutely. It's no trick question at all. Ukraine is just the latest chapter in the conflict between the West / NATO and Russia. I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Usually, people that answer such big questions that take up much more time, but I appreciate it. Nicholas, essentially the same question to you, because, you know, when we looked at the spectacular drone attack on Russia about a week ago, we also had some terrorist attacks on bridges and rail freight and passenger lines. But these one is a continuation of the other, because the attack on this, Russia's strategic assets is much more broad. It's a broader Western attack on Russia, not necessarily having anything to do with Ukraine.
Yeah. I mean, all of this, as you say, is part of an underlying conflict that most people refer to as the new Cold War, although it's really a revival of the old Cold War between the United States and its allies and Russia and its allies. And but when we look at those two incidents, one was clearly an act of terrorism, and the other was a covert operation. You know, it's still unclear exactly who was involved in that. I think few people believe that Ukraine could have done that on its own. They've had, you know, the U.S., the CIA, the British, MI6, have all been deeply involved in this conflict from the very beginning. And so, I'm sure the Russian intelligence services are trying to figure out exactly who was involved in that and will respond, once they do.
You know, because, Angelo, it's very interesting in looking at these separate attacks, one on strategic nuclear assets and then terrorism here. One has to believe, it's common sense, that there would be outside influences, actors like the CIA and MI6, because attacking those nuclear assets didn't change the calculus of the battlefield in Ukraine. So, obviously, the attack benefits whom? It doesn't benefit Ukraine.
No, absolutely not. They're hoping for an escalation and involvement of NATO. So I think here you have a Kiev regime which is completely, absolutely desperate. And they're losing. The only way they can be relevant is by being on the news and doing those terrorist attacks. But if you are looking at the fundamentals haven't changed since 2022. Russia had all the foundation for winning. Ukraine and even NATO didn't have even the industrial capacity to match the capacity of Russia. So the war on paper already was over in 2022. Keep in mind that what we are living here is what the RAND Corporation in 2019 was planning. Yeah. The paper was called Extending Russia. Yeah. And it was how we can weaken Russia and using Ukraine, fight Russia to the last Ukrainian and funding massively Ukraine.
Well, also, if we look at some terminology here, I'll go back to Michael in New York. I remember very well, because I was living here with the conflict in Chechnya, and that was an anti-terrorist operation. What's going on now in Ukraine is a special military operation. There are legal differences, and we don't want to waste too much time on it, but they're very different. The SMO could turn into an anti-terrorist operation, which has amazing implications. For example, decapitating the leadership in Kyiv, et cetera. Go ahead, Michael.
You know, this is something that I always wondered why Russia never decided to do in the beginning. In the United States, when we like to implement regime change, we go right to the Capitol, we decapitate the leadership, and then we spend the next 20 years trying to pacify the country before it's no longer a trending hashtag, and then we pull out saying that, well, we accomplished our goal anyway. You know, Russia, on the other hand, seems to be playing this quite differently, keeping Kyiv largely outside of, you know, most of the major attacks. I mean, obviously, there have been missile strikes within Kyiv, but there has yet to be an open declaration of a full-on removal of the Zelensky government, even though multiple times the Russian government has called the Zelensky government a terrorist regime and one that is engaging in multiple war crimes. So what the strategy is something that is still, in my opinion, largely kept within inner Kremlin circles.
Yeah, Nicholas, I mean, there's obviously frustration, too. I mean, Russians are not gleeful about this war. They want it to come to an end. They don't have animus towards Ukrainians whatsoever, but they do have animus towards the regime. And it seems to me that the next step forward will have to be some form of regime change. That does not necessarily mean political assassinations, but it's about time, and I think this is up what the escalation ladder dictates, is that Russia will have to consider this. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Yeah, I mean, the West has been essentially escalating little by little by little, as Macron said over a year ago, that towards a point where the West will have to commit more of its own forces. Now, make no mistake, this is a war between NATO and Russia, and Western forces are already deeply involved. There's an entire command center set up in Germany where, as the Ukrainians have said, they do not fire a single HIMARS rocket without targeting data supplied by U.S. forces in Germany. And so, you know, when Biden said there are no American forces fighting in Ukraine, he was lying. They are, but they're fighting from a safe distance. And this creates the illusion of peace for the Western public and the Americans in particular. This has been part of American grand strategy for a long time, to create the illusion of peace for its own people, even as it wreaks violence and chaos and havoc across the world. But how, you know, with this new operation that they conducted against this Russian strategic bombers, we keep hitting these points where it seems that there will be a greater response from Russia. And so far, the West has not managed to provoke a much greater response. Russia has proceeded cautiously, obviously, fully conscious of the danger of nuclear war. Now, what is NATO trying to do here? Trump reportedly told Putin, he says he told President Putin, that he did not know about this operation.
Well, you don't know.
We have to wonder what is going on here. It would not be the first time that the CIA has conducted operations in flat opposition to what an American president is saying. You know, this has happened in other places in the world.
Yes, but it begs the question, and let me go to Angela on this one. So it doesn't really matter who's in the White House. It's the, what you can call it, the deep state, the permanent bureaucracy, whatever. They're the ones calling the shot. It doesn't matter who's in the White House.
No, absolutely. It's been always like this. And keep in mind that who's dictating the policies, the long-term policies of the U.S. are the think tank organizations, which are actually funded and controlled by the military-industrial complex. So it doesn't matter. Even though Trump is coming with a new discourse, he's telling us once in a while things that we like to hear. But ultimately, we need to focus on facts. And the policy of Trump, even though he has done something which is positive, he reached out to Putin. But in reality, what he's doing is nothing else than the good cop and the bad cop. He's taking the side of the role of the bad cop, the good cop, and he's giving the good cop role to the EU. And this is what Peter Hegseth said very clearly. This is what we call a division of labor. He wants to put this conflict, the Ukrainian conflict, the EU in charge of this conflict, including in terms of defense spending. They should increase by 2 to 5%. And guess what? Most of the weapons will be purchased from coming from the US. And at the same time, it won't change anything. What happens, that's what Trump wants to do, is to shift attention and resources towards East, because he's preparing for the ultimate battle, which is China. So in reality, Trump is not a man of peace. I know this will not please the MAGA fanboys, but we need to stop listening to Trump. In reality, I would say Peter Hegseth is probably much more accurate. He's much more interesting to listen to, because he's really telling what the U.S. is going to do. Trump is all there for confusion. He's confusing people and ultimately focus not on what he says, but the actions.
Well,
actions.
I think the most important action will be on the horizon is new money for Ukraine. And that is doubtful right now, considering the problems he has with the big, beautiful bill. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Michael in New York. At the very end of the first part of the program, there was the mention of the division of labor. Well, let's dig into that a little bit here. Mark Rutte, the General Secretary of NATO, in the last couple of news cycles, he's been very busy running off his mouth, claiming that Russia could attack NATO within 5 years. I don't know why 5 years, but, I mean, he's talking about escalation, going on a war footing, putting it that way. Also, he said, which is really quite remarkable, that, you know, if he's warning Britons, if they don't increase their defense spending, they have a choice, increase defense spending or learn Russian. I mean, is this a serious person? Go ahead, Michael.
I mean, it sort of reminds me back in the Cold War.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Cold War, too. Go ahead, yes.
But it reminds me of all of those little bunkers that Enver Hoxha and Albania built with this understanding that this is going to defend the country against a global invasion of a country that no one even knew where it was on the map. I mean, I'm sure it was really good money for the construction crews. And Rutte's statement about NATO having to go to war with Russia in 5 years, or however long it is, we've been hearing about this now for almost 5 years. So I'm not exactly sure whether we have 2 years left or the five-year mark is constantly being reset. But it definitely keeps the security dilemma alive within the NATO sphere. But more to the point, it's the same person, and these are the same leaders that a week ago were saying Russia does not want peace. Russia is stalling. Russia should come to the negotiating table and find a lasting, peaceful solution. And yet, these are the same people that are now ratcheting up the military narrative and at the same time condoning missile strikes within Russia that give Putin absolutely no reason whatsoever to come to the negotiating table. You know, I teach a class in university called conflict resolution, and part of conflict resolution is conflict management. And you need to manage the conflict before you resolve it. By the attacks in Russia on military as well as civilian targets, I'm not exactly sure what the goal was, because it's not getting Ukraine any closer to achieving its 1991 borders. But what it is doing is giving Putin, Lavrov, and everyone else all the reason to believe that there is no reason whatsoever to find any compromise, any lasting solution between Russia and the West, let alone Russia and Ukraine.
Well, because essentially what they want is a surrender. That's what they mean by peace, okay? And also thinking of how words are used and abused. You know, Nicholas, from the very beginning, and I'm talking about 2014 when there was the coup in Kyiv, I talked about this as being a proxy conflict, and then it turned into a hot proxy conflict in 2022. So, you know, but I said that and I was attacked. Now it's common parlance to say the proxy war. Western audiences are being prepared that we are at war with Russia. Slowly but surely, you have the think tank saying it, politicians saying it, pundits saying it. It's a proxy war. We're at war with Russia, is what they're saying.
Yes, absolutely. And we all know that a war between, and Biden even acknowledged this, that a war between the United States and Russia is, by definition, the Third World War. It will, and people like Lawrence Wilkerson, who was involved in wargaming this many, many times, and he, you know, have warned that every projection that the U.S. military makes as to how that would go is that it would very quickly go nuclear. And again, Biden himself said that he did not believe, even as he was ratcheting up towards that, absolutely irresponsibly, he acknowledged that he did not believe that a limited nuclear strike could be prevented from actually leading to full-scale nuclear war. That is what we are flirting with here, and that is why, the only responsible solution for all sides is to come to the table and negotiate an end to this dangerous.
Yeah, but Nicholas, but negotiating would be a strategic defeat for NATO. Angelo, that's how they would interpret it.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is pure madness. Keep in mind, I think there are just two alternatives. It's either NATO loses and we come up with an agreement, peace agreement, but an agreement that actually would make sure that there's no war in 5 or 10 years. It's not going to be a Minsk III. So we need to have security guarantees for the whole continent. So in reality, if you can you imagine NATO losing, that means this whole globalist project ending, and actually could be a trigger for the end of the EU as well. And the other alternative is very simple. This is nuclear war, because it is existential. Russia will not lose. So where are we going here? I think we have mad people especially on the Western side, especially when you look at how this war started. And I would say a lot of people, they focus on 2014. I would say this started already in 1945.
Yeah, yeah.
1945, Churchill was already thinking, there was a paper called Thinking the Unthinkable. The Soviets were in Berlin, and he was thinking, why do we maybe try to hit the Soviets? And since then, there was a Cold War. But ultimately, the aim was to attack Russia. Why? Because it's $75 trillion of natural resources. And the Lebensraum, what we have, you know, when we look at the EU, this is an extension of a Nazi project of unifying Europe and expanding. EU didn't start after 1945. It was already a Nazi project. And when you look at the paperclip project, all those Nazis were recycled, guess where, into NATO and into the EU.
Well, exactly, Michael, and that's why any kind of real, genuine negotiation is really basically criminalized. You can't negotiate. And that's the dilemma that the West has put itself in, because Russia is not going to lose this conflict. It is existential. It will not lose. It's up to the West how they manage it. Go ahead, Michael.
Right, which I think in a way suits Putin just fine. He has gone on record to say multiple times that the West cannot be trusted to abide by any international agreement. You know, Angelo had just mentioned that this will not be a Minsk III, which is great, because as far as Putin is concerned, Minsk II was an absolute betrayal. The documents were signed, but nothing was ever ratified. And now we know that Merkel and Hollande had told Poroshenko, don't worry about anything, just stall. You know, we will arm you to the point where you can take Donbass back by force, you know, very similar to Azerbaijan's takeover of Karabakh, Croatia's takeover of Krajina, and, you know, no disputed territory, no problem. Russia is not Armenia. Russia is not late 90s Yugoslavia. Even though, you know, I did notice a couple of parallels. NATO bombing of Belgrade in 99 were not just simply military or strategic targets, but they were civilian targets. There was a passenger train. There was the RTS building. There was the Chinese embassy, which yeah. they always say, oops, we didn't oops. Know about that one, which I think was just, you know, look, yeah, well, if you're going to lie,
that's, you need to lie. That's the hybrid nature of it, because it was strategic and it was terrorism. That is the parallel.
Sure.
Nicholas, you know, we've all, I mean, it was one of my questions I wanted to ask. It's already been brought up. Minsk, that's an impossible. You know why? Because it didn't work, okay? It didn't work. And Istanbul was what came to an end because the Ukrainians pulled out of it with the backing of their Western friends. So the Istanbul process, outside of prisoner exchanges and things like that, that's also dead. But that's a decision made in the West.
Yes, well, the I think you're talking about Minsk, but I think that if there is anything we can hold up as something of a model, it is the neutrality agreement that Russia and Ukraine had on the table little more than a month into the war in 2022. And it was Boris Johnson who went to Kiev and upended that, and which Biden and Secretary Austin supported. They chose, the West made a choice at that point, instead of allowing Ukraine to make peace with Russia on terms that Ukraine, the Ukrainian negotiators, were so happy. Arestovich has said that they came home to Kyiv and were popping champagne bottles open. They were so pleased with the result of those negotiations. And it's very, very simple. No NATO for Ukraine. Russian forces were ready to withdraw from the newly occupied territory. The people of Donbass and Crimea would have self-determination to decide their permanent status. And, you know, everything was more or less agreed. And so, so that, you know, the fact that, so Ukraine and Russia's real long-term interests can both be satisfied.
Okay, but let me, we have 1 minute left. I want to go to Angelo. And looking at the Istanbul process at the start of the conflict here, that was a victory for Ukraine, absolutely, if you read it. But it wasn't enough for a strategic defeat of Russia. That's why the West didn't go along with it. It didn't guarantee a strategic defeat of Russia. Go ahead. You have the last 40 seconds.
No, absolutely. They wanted to drag on this war just to weaken Russia. There's still a hope, I would say, in the West, too, that this could still destabilize Russia. And they're hoping for a miracle, but this is just suicidal. But ultimately, guess what? If the war continues, this favors who? it favors the military industrial complex, and it still weakens a bit Russia. And those people, they do not care about Ukrainian lives, so they can go on. And this war is allowing, is giving a good excuses to EU leaders to lift up the military.
Well, gentlemen, we've run out of time, but the longer this war continues, the greater the possibility of it escalating to where we all do not want to go. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in New York, Miami, and in Bangkok. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.